Good afternoon. E12 Education Finance Conference Committee will come to order. And so since we have completed the walkthroughs and had the staff go through the tracking sheets and that at our last meeting, and that Senator Nelson and I thought it might be useful just to have some dialogue with the Senate and House Conference Committee members about a few of the items that are different between the House and Senate bills. And we can have a fuller discussion about maybe either from the authors or from the side, which is proponent of the provision, why and what the rationale is. Members can ask questions. We can have a full understanding. So really today is devoted to discussion time on some of those items. And if we need further clarification, obviously we can rely on our nonpartisan staff. And I didn't get a chance to see. I know that there's some department staff here, too. Thank you, Mr. Ooney and Caitlin. So if we have any questions or need clarifications from the department, I hope you'll would be willing to come forward if that's necessary. So I think if you want to turn to the pages in your books so you can follow along and what we're going to do, I thought we would start with a provision that was in the House bill, a school finance working group. This was a proposal brought to us by Representative Erdahl. It was modified a little bit from his original proposal to be a legislative working group, but on the topic of school finance and just sort of delving into the details of our formulas, how we finance schools in Minnesota, and looking at those issues. So the page is R16 under Article 2. Article 1, R16.
Article 2?
All right, it depends. Are we looking at the revisers? So on R16, Article 1, it's Section 14 from the House bill on the right side. Again, the Legislative Study Group on School Finance. And we did make a couple of revisions to Representative Erdahl's original bill. And again, to form it more as a Legislative Study Group. The rationale for this was modeled on the teacher licensure working group, which was convened over the summer and actually was, I think, very effective in terms of convening members, taking public testimony, and then eventually using the basis of that information to form legislative product, which is now actually in conference committee on the teacher licensure issues. So, and again, this study group would look at everything from compensatory revenue, sort of the basic funding formula, revenue, special education. We do some funding in that for facilities. And I think it's been quite some time since something of this nature has been done. I don't know, Mr. Strom, if you recall the last time there was any kind of a formal study or working group on how to fund schools.
Madam Chair, members, I believe in 2012 and 2013 were the years that the Department of Education convened the school finance working groups on a variety of topics.
Okay. And so, and I think as we examine this area, I know I get a lot of comments from school districts wondering about the discrepancies between school districts of how they're funded, the per pupil differences between districts. Some of that's keyed into specific formulas. Some of it has to do with referendum dollars. There's a lot of differences there. But I do think that this would be a worthwhile exercise as we look at, again, trying to remove disparities between schools and how we fund them, making sure that all students get equal opportunities wherever they reside and go to school across the state of Minnesota. So that was the rationale for doing it. Again, the legislative study group, because it seemed to work well for the licensure issue. So, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this has been an ongoing issue, school finance, and is it fair and is it achieving the results that we want? Just this week, I've had superintendents talk to me about the transportation funding and the inequity in the transportation funding and the costs associated with that. Those that are unpaid, of course, come right out of their operating expenses. Of course, we've heard about broadband funding, too. Some districts pay exorbitant amounts for broadband, and so there's the broadband inequity. And, of course, we've long heard about special education and the special education cost subsidy and the difficulty that that causes certain districts. So just this week, three different cost subsidies have come to my office, the need for transportation, broadband, and a special education, which I think really does point to that we do need to have, I think, an exhaustive look at our school finance system and make sure that we are actually financing what works and that we're being fair for all students to have great opportunities. I do have a couple questions. These would be historical questions that perhaps a member or Mr. Strom or someone else might be able to give me some insight on. So there was a school finance working group in 2012 and 2013. And so what I would like to know is what were the results of that working group? Did they identify things? And if so, we should maybe start looking at that, not starting at ground zero. And then also I think it's important to look at, well, what's happened. We're in 2017 now. And so what's happened in the ensuing 4 years from the results from this working group? Because I do not think it would be helpful for us to have a working group just to have a working group or a study group or a legislative group just to have a study group. And sometimes I do think we might do that just to get something done. But I think we really have to be focused on results here. And so those are some historical pieces that I would like to know about the school finance working group from 2012 and 13. And if no one is prepared today to speak to that, maybe that's something we can incorporate later.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. I'll call on Mr. Strom in a moment or if any other staff have something to add, and I'll also invite the department if they have anything to add. But I would completely agree with your comments about not just having a working group for the sake of it. I think part of the reason the working group, legislative working group, works so well on the licensure issue is that we had a very critical need to produce something to resolve a longstanding problem. Of course, it was spurred, I think, by the OLA study, which pointed out the fact that our current system on licensure was not working, and definitely some attention and some action was needed by the legislature to rectify that. So, I could imagine a working group in which, again, we could sort of admire problems or discrepancies within it. It may not necessarily lead to a solution, but I think for the purposes of being truly helpful and assistive in the process of funding our schools, we would want to have some concrete things that could be proposed. I think I will say one of the things I was concerned about or didn't want to include was talking about necessarily the adequacy of funding, because I could foresee a problem or a process where it was only focused on lots more dollars. I want to make sure that the fairness within the formula distribution as it exists would be examined, whether it adequately addresses the needs of different types of schools, small schools, rural, urban, suburban, all of those things would need to be important factors. So, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, I am just glancing at the Department of Education's website. I think they have a variety of the documents from their last working group still on their website. They've rearranged things a bit in the last year. The last group of recommendations essentially dealt with facilities purposes, and that's, as this committee may remember, where the long-term facilities maintenance revenue came from. Some of the earlier recommendations regarding general school finances, some of those evolved, as it were, into the 2013 session with the referendum changes there. But I'd be happy to try and find a quick summary and have that distributed to members here that shows the working plan for the last group of task force.
Thank you. And Mr. Shum, just further, I know that changes were made to the special education formula. Was that an outgrowth of that working group process, do you recall?
Madam Chair, that's my memory. I don't want to misspeak on that, but I believe there were four or so groups that were working on different topics, and I believe special education was one of those.
Thank you. And if members have questions, otherwise I would ask Mr. Uni to come up. Senator Weaker.
Oh, thanks, Madam Chair. And I served as an alternate on that 2012 group, Senator Stump. I was the most active in the Senate, and I think it can provide very worthwhile information, just as you had cited the licensure group. And I think it sends a signal that, look before you leap, get thoughtful recommendations in front of us. It was the basis for a number of changes, pupil waiting, deferred maintenance, et cetera. State business property tax, too, is a part of that that did get repealed subsequently, but we won't go there. The one item, and you mentioned compensatory reform as something that they could look at, and I do note that in the House proposal you have a number of things on compensatory, and might that be a better thing for this group? You cited this as an example, compensatory, for them to delve into that before we did anything with a long-range implication.
Thank you, Senator Rieger. I think that's a fair topic, and actually that's one of the topics where I had planned on us talking today about. So when we morph into that topic next, I think that's a good discussion to have. Representative Krishna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe Representative Erickson was on the committee as well. And so this would be for Representative Erickson or Senator Weaver. I'm just wondering, with those conversations, when you received the recommendations, did it help remove some of the partisan biases that went out and gave you the ability to have the committees to have a more fuller conversation without some of those partisan attacks?
And Senator Weaver.
Madam Chair, yes.
Representative Krishna,
or
did you have anything further?
Madam Chair and Representative Krishna, we had to determine a recommendation which was a bipartisan recommendation. So we had five meetings. Many, many, many stakeholders testified many times. So as we listened and learned, we, I think, evolved into the recommendations that we finally reported out of the legislative group. And Madam Chair, one of the advantages is that the Legislative Coordinating Commission is very good about organizing and helping, because legislators do this without pay or mileage. So we were, dedicating our time during campaign season, actually, to do this. But I thought, and I think Senator Weaker would agree, it was a was an invaluable experience. Legislators have to own this when it's a legislative study group. Not the outsiders, but the legislators.
Thank you. All right. So, Mr. Uni, thank you so much for being here and for coming forward. If you would have anything to add from the department's discussion, I'm trying to remember if maybe you weren't even there then.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, my name is Joe Shuni, Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. It did actually predate me by a year. However, when I did start at the legislature, they were implementing a few of the first recommendations, and I believe between Mr. Strom and Senator Weaver, they covered a lot of the areas, the people waiting, referendum, other equalization areas, I believe some special education, student achievement, statewide levy. I'm more than happy. I've already put in a request with Dr. Melcher to receive some of the reports and any summaries, and we're more than happy to work with Mr. Strom to provide that for the committee, and should we need to discuss this at any future date, be more than happy to come back and talk to that.
Okay. And Mr. Uni, do you know if the department would have any particular concerns about a working group if that provision is in some manner retained in the final omnibus bill, if there would be any concerns from the department on that?
Madam Chair, committee members, I don't think there'd be any concerns outright. I think one of the ways we'd like to go is pursuing some of maybe the changes that are actually implemented in the bill, actually looking at them, and I know you said you're going to discuss that, especially around compensatory revenue, maybe pumping the brakes on that and taking a look at that in the legislative study group. We'd obviously would like to be involved and provide information. Obviously, we'd be the source for a lot of how the funding flow works along with legislative staff here, I'm sure, but as it looks, the legislature has done legislative task force before, and they've worked just fine, so I think we would be fine with the model.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Uni. Any questions for Mr. Uni or other comments on this topic area? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having served on the Senate Education Committee for 4 years prior, I think it's a good idea from the standpoint that I look at certain issues and even various items in the last couple of weeks I've been brought up to date on, because when I returned from Easter break, this was not a committee that I expected to be on at that point in time. But, you know, I think I look at things, for example, like our regional library system. And we've had, in terms of how that's funded, we've had like a basic part of the formula they get, and then there's been the other adjusting compensatory part of it that's based on formulas that, quite frankly, are too wide, changed too quickly, because it dealt with property base. So when you had the home values go down horribly in the metro area some years ago, all of a sudden that changed their funding stream, and as land values went up, it changed in a negative way some of our rural regional library systems, to a point where they're having to discontinue certain stops that they're even making. And yet the reality of it is, for neither one of them did their basic operation change that warranted such a change in their financial structure. And I think there are probably other areas within our education funding that, quite frankly, fall prey to the same kind of problems. And I think it's a good opportunity to try and achieve stabilization in some of these formulas. You know, we sometimes, our definition of fairness sometimes runs amok, unfortunately.
And you're correct, and sometimes can be in the eye of the beholder as well. So
yeah.
I think well stated, Senator Weber. Other comments? All right. Thank you, Mr. Uni, and thank you, committee members. As I said, we'll come back to that. I don't think we're prepared to make any motions or offer amendments on adopting anything today, but I just thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of discuss some of these things that were different and sound out any questions or concerns conference committee members might have. So next, I wanted to turn to the topic of compensatory revenue reform. Again, these were items that were in the House bill. So page R12 in Article 1. All right, so start through, right down at the very bottom of page 12, section 11, targeted compensatory revenue. And really the idea behind this initiative was to really try to move the needle, honestly, on the achievement gap. And we have this separate source of funding that flows to schools according to children whose families' income falls into the free or reduced price lunch category. And this formula also has a concentration factor, so when more students falling into that category are located in a particular school building, the funding is then increased by a certain magnitude for that. And Mr. Strom, I was trying to think of when this funding was put into place. How many years have we had compensatory as a component of our school funding formula?
Madam Chair, members, in 1987, the legislature created the current compensatory revenue formula, and it's been relatively the same since that point in time. Prior to that, the concept of compensatory revenue and the concentration existed, but it was actually done through the pupil unit weighting. So under the former program that was called the Foundation Aid Program, compensatory revenue was actually, the concept we used was something called total pupil units, and that reflected the count. And at that time, the count was based on the family's eligibility for AFDC, which was determined by the county. So it was a district-level count taken by the county, essentially, that was then turned over to the school districts and MDE for purposes of calculating the total pupil units.
Thank you. The House actually did a full day of hearing on compensatory revenue. We brought in a number of testifiers to talk about the formula. We talked to some school districts on how they use their compensatory formula. We had, I think, representatives from those in the pilot, those pilot schools, as well as, I know we heard from Minneapolis, I believe St. Paul, a variety of school districts talking about their programs and how they operate. And so through that, one of the initiatives that we did include in the House was taking a try at further targeting the use of compensatory revenue for a specific purpose. And the purpose is extended time, so providing additional time to assist struggling students with this revenue to try to help them improve their academic performance. Mm-hmm. And the sort of inspiration, if you will, for that came from an OLA report from 2010, and they measured the results of growth on test scores and measurements of students if given extended time programs and how they did, and found that basically those students who received extended time in a targeted manner experienced higher growth than those who didn't. 29% in math and 30% in reading of the students in extended time experienced high growth, and 40% of the students in extended time experienced medium growth compared to other students. So it is a strategy that is sort of proven to work, and I know we have all struggled to get our arms around how we make an impact, how we try to help improve academic performance for struggling students and closing the achievement gap. So this is idea for how we might be able to do that, and it would be through targeting the growth in compensatory dollars that go to our schools for extended time purposes. Now, there is another aspect to the formula, which I know is controversial, and that would be adjusting the formula going to schools according to their MCA participation. Maybe we want to set that aside for a separate discussion, and so in order to kind of organize our thoughts and discussion, let's just first talk about the compensatory aspect of it. But anyway, so that was sort of the inspiration or the idea behind making this change. Could we direct in a more specific purpose the use of compensatory funds, and would this be something we could see if greater results or enhanced results were achieved by schools by using that money for extra time for struggling students? So with that, I throw it open for comments, for questions, for clarifications. Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. What was the response from the school boards? We respect local control and flexibility for decision makers, those are local elected officials, to best decide how to allocate that, and then we're going to further inject some guidance. What was the testimony from school boards?
Well, I'm trying to recall. I think some of those concerns were raised about, again,
directing where those funds would be used. I have met with a number of superintendents, some have expressed a concern or said that they already have a pretty robust extended time program for some schools. For some, they don't have as much of one, and the issue of transportation is also an issue that comes up as well for students and how they would accommodate that. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touched on one of my questions, too, which had to do with, first, let's say extended time has been proven to work. And years ago, Title I, of course, operated off of that principle in that Title I dollars could supplement, but they could not supplant. And I kind of get a sense that might be where you're going here with this as well. So we want additional dollars to actually supplement what's being done, not to supplant. And I get a sense that's the case here as well. And I did have a question regarding the local control aspect, which you've touched on. And also, though it is true, these extended time programs, I started the extended time program at Willow Creek Elementary School when I was a reading teacher there. And, of course, there's a whole host of other things that go with that, including transportation, and we did some other things as well. So I think that has to be considered, which I'm sure it would be. I would like to know if there's any distribution. Let's set aside the controversial provision about the MCAs, and I am wondering in the House language, I understand new compensatory dollars would be targeted to extended time. I understand that part of the provision. Is there another part that deals with the distribution of those compensatory dollars? And if you could speak to that, please.
Yes, thank you, Senator Nelson. Yes, I neglected to have a discussion about that. So the distribution also would be changed to would not include a concentration factor. So all compensatory money up through, you know, the current budget year would go out as it has, but the new money would not include a concentration factor. And we had a little bit of discussion about this in committee as well, whether or not there has been a concern from some school districts, and I think in some manner this was the reason for the pilot that's been in place for 12 years, was that school districts that have a number of children who would qualify for compensatory, but because of their school district structure or maybe the size of their buildings or being spread out, is that they may serve a significant number of children whose families qualify for free and reduced lunch, so they'd receive compensatory funds, but would not qualify for the concentration factor because of the configuration of their district. And again, is it fair to treat children differently based upon whether or not they're concentrated in one building or not? Obviously, there's other considerations on the other side of that argument, and there's a reason it was put into place. But I do think, and we did have some testimony on this, as sort of the landscape of our schools is changing a bit, we do know that poverty is not necessarily all concentrated in urban areas or in certain schools, that it's becoming a bit more of a factor in schools no matter where they be located. And so is this something we should be looking at in just funding children who qualify for compensatory all on an equal basis?
Thank you. Madam Chair, and then it would be important at some point that we actually see runs of what these different proposals would look like, current distribution formula, including the pilot compensatories as well. So I think at some point, hopefully, we'll have those for our members.
Yes, and we'll get those prepared and send those to members. I would expect we could probably have that before our next meeting, depending on when that is.
Right.
So, thank you. Other comments, questions, discussion on this? Senator Weigel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to acknowledge your appreciation for the recognition of the importance of extended time revenue And it's my understanding that President Trump's budget would cut over $9 million for Minnesota alone on that important cost-effective program. So ways we can preserve that will be important through other ways.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. And I think, you know, as we have all struggled, as I've mentioned, to try to find ways to narrow and close our achievement or our opportunity gap, we do know that there's no one solution. But when we find a solution that, again, has research-based results and it shows that it makes a difference, I think it behooves us to pay attention to that. And, you know, I've been a big advocate of flexibility for the schools and how they manage their programs, how they develop things to address the needs of their learners. But unfortunately, if you just look at MCA scores alone, it's been pretty flat over the past few years. And so it makes me wonder if we need to try something new to get better results. And so, again, that was the rationale behind the provision that I offered in the House bill that's before us. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, in the last couple of weeks I've had a brief conversation but then read a couple of newspaper articles as a result too. In our area, there's a citizens group that have been looking at equity between the schools, and they were wondering if doing away with the pilot and making it a permanent thing. It was really wise because they've been getting great help from the Department of Education on what money to follow and so forth between equity of programs in 709's case between the two high schools. And finding out that it wasn't in their mind, in the citizens group's mind, it wasn't balanced, and it wasn't fair. But what I don't have what their definition of fair was, but I know what they were getting at and what they were questioning. And in the case, as they were explaining to me, it seemed to be, how often did the local control change? And if that, and maybe one person said, maybe that didn't change often enough because it didn't keep up. And now they have these results of their survey and the imbalance, and they wanted to tug more money back. In one place, but they had no idea how it would tip it over on the other side. And so they were hoping that there would still be flexibility and local control, but more fairness and more opportunity for the citizens to know exactly how the financing was working. So that's just what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they wanted an answer from me, and I just said, well, keep talking to the Department of Education because they know more. They were getting daily responses to their phone calls, and they were very happy about that.
And Representative Murphy, so the two schools that you were talking about, does one have money that flows to them via the concentration factor and one does not? Is that a bit of the crux of the discussion?
The one was getting more of that than they should in a couple of these people's minds.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, and like I said, I think it's a fair argument, or at least a point of discussion when looking at that. And it is a factor for a lot of our schools, as I said, as the demographics have changed. And then there is an additional money that flows to some of the schools with that changing demographics, not as, as other schools have seen it.
And I remember, you know, the testimony from two years ago when they were talking about the district as a whole and being able to get some of the money to the kids who most need, even though their district as a whole wasn't eligible, but there were kids there in those areas that needed more help. And I remember that testimony and that discussion, and mm-hmm. I know exactly what you're trying to get at.
Yes,
we'll have to make a decision.
Trying to have the best of all worlds,
right.
I think. Yeah. And yes, we did have a lot of discussion on that. I think what we ended up was about half, like 50% of the compensatory revenue was available for the school district to move around as necessarily, because they had a school that did not receive sort of the concentration factor, but they had a lot of English language learners in that school that they needed to provide extra support for. And so they have the flexibility of doing that. And I think that is important. I think so in trying to see if we can do almost a pilot to see if we can affect more positive change, again, looking at only the new money, which would be, you know, a portion, a fairly small portion, actually, of the compensatory revenue the school would receive overall in trying this extended time factor. Other comments or things people would like to add to the discussion? Okay. All right. And did the department want to comment on this? I know we kind of touched on it, but if you had anything new you wanted to add, Mr. Uni, please feel free to just pop up whenever you'd like. Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, members, again, Adoshini with the Department of Education. I believe that the commissioner has testified several times and provided letters on this issue area and her strong concerns with the approach to de-linking the compensatory revenue, but moving away from a concentration factor to a ratio factor. I know you've discussed about the contentions around the weighting based on MCA participation. But as well as, I believe I mentioned de-linking, and then that the ability to shift the funding between sites that may or may not have generated the actual funding. As she mentioned, Ed Trust has rated us as one of the top states for our funding in terms of equity, and at the core of that rating comes our compensatory revenue model, which really focuses money at the students that need it the most. That's really our embedded targeted formula that we have right now for our media students based on income. And so, you know, on behalf of the commissioner, I would strongly suggest that if we do take another approach towards compensatory, I think we would want to just look at the formula through the study group and get more input from schools and educators who work with the student groups and work with these funding flows. But at this point, I think as the commissioner has said right now, we have very strong concerns about this approach to compensatory revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. And just a question. I don't know, I've talked with the commissioner about this well, and she mentioned sort of the national rating. Do you know if that rating, how much of that is reflective of the concentration factor, or is it just that our state perhaps is head and shoulders above others of having a separate funding stream that goes to schools according to children from low-income families?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, I don't believe that rating is just solely based on our compensatory revenue system. I believe our achievement and integration formula factors into it as well. I haven't done an analysis of comparing to other states. I'm more than happy to provide not only the article, but some of our looks at it and to provide a little bit more context for the committee.
Thank you. And also, Mr. Uni, do you know, and I know maybe this is tied in a little bit to the world's best workforce and what the schools are doing, but is there something in those reports that indicates or the department's able to look at as you're reviewing their plans and that how the compensatory revenue figures into their efforts, those five things they're supposed to do in showing progress in, again, narrowing and closing the achievement gap.
Madam Chair, members, so as I'm not involved on the teams that are specifically reviewing it, I know that when we do look at our districts and, you know, that are and how they stack up compared to their individual goals that are individualized to the particular district and or charter, we're going to look at their major funding flows and how they sync up with their closing their achievement gaps, graduation rates, and the other three areas. Compensatory revenue is one that we'll be looking at, and how they've, now that they have 50% discretion, we'll look at how they've allocated that funding, if they have shifted it around in different ways. You know, one of the ways that we've saw it for the compensatory pilots is they may not have a high concentration, but they do have poverty spread out. We'll be looking at the context of each individual district that is maybe struggling to perform, and compensatory, should that be a major factor in their overall funding, will be one that we'll look at.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Any questions for Mr. or Senator Nelson?
Just a comment, and then actually a question for the House members. I appreciate Mr. Uni, the focus on targeting resources. I think that's what I hear you talking about here with the compensatory funding, that it is targeting resources to the greatest need. And I think that is a, we always live in a time of limited resources, and I think that's a critical critical strategic move for the targeting of those resources like we do with compensatory. So appreciate your comments there. And then I just had a question for the House on the particular language on R13 on lines 11.6 to 11.8. I'm wondering if somebody could kind of flesh that out. What would that look like in practice? So that would be paragraph B, subdivision 6, paragraph B.
Good. I guess I'll ask if nonpartisan staff wants to give an explanation, just so I'm not coloring it with my
Chair, members,
point of
just,
view. Mr. Strom.
Just to make sure I'm in the right place, Senator Nelson, paragraph B of subdivision 6, is that right?
Yes, and maybe you want to read it just for the audience, so in case they don't have this page in front of them, they know exactly what we're talking about here.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. In terms of the revenue uses, compensatory revenue is already reserved by the regular statute governing compensatory revenue. And the new paragraph B reads that the targeted compensatory revenue generated at a school site under this section may be used at any school site provided the services are provided to the students enrolled at the site generating the revenue. And it's my understanding that when the House added that language, there was some concern that extended programming may be at a different site. For example, a summer school might be held at a school building that has air conditioning, so that those children might have gone to a different school during the school year, but during the extended time period over the summer, for example, would be at a different site, that money would essentially be tied to those children, but could move sites if there were a different building in use.
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that clarification. I do think that's an important point, that certainly money follows the student that is that it's targeted for. So thank you for that clarification.
Thank you. Senator Wigger.
Yes, Madam Chair, I think each of us received from Mr. Uni a copy of the report during our discussion, and thanks for doing that. And on point on compensatory ed, the nonpartisan group that studied this recommendation 5, just it's pretty brief, reform compensatory funding to more effectively close the achievement gaps by allocate all compensatory revenue based on poverty concentration instead of allocating a portion of compensatory revenue based on hours of extended time instruction, and allow districts greater flexibility in the use of compensatory revenue. So that was the study.
Thank you. Other comments? Questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One piece of this discussion that I've heard, maybe from a slightly different point of view, comes more from the gifted and talented, where students are generating revenue and the money isn't necessarily being used specifically for programs for those students. And I guess, you know, one caution I might have, while I agree with Senator Wiener, we need to give local school districts as much flexibility as, you know, to meet their needs. If we start getting into the scenario where students in one area are generating revenue for the district being used somewhere else, we do run that risk of criticism that I think we need to be careful about.
Well, thank you, Senator Pratt. And I think, you know, just my own comments, I won't speak for all of the House conferees, but, you know, I think flexibility is good to the point that we're seeing results. Mm-hmm. And so if more flexibility is not improving the desired result, then maybe that's not the direction in which we should be going. So, again, I think, you know, it's important to allow the schools the latitude to try things that may work, but again, when we know that there are strategies that are proven to work if they aren't being employed or maybe not being employed effectively, I do think it is the role of the legislature to examine those things and perhaps suggest, or more strongly than suggest, they be employed. Other comments, questions, clarifications? Oh, okay, yes. Yes, the working group report. Thank you, Mr. Uni, for making that available. And we'll, if the pages want to go ahead and hand those out. Thank you very much. All right. So. Okay. So before we turn away from this, I know I set it aside, but it's part of this discussion, and then we'll go on to our next topic, and that was the connection of MCA participation to this as well. And I know I think that was probably one of the more one of the most controversial aspects of this, if that's possible. And again, I think of concern is what I see is a growing opt-out movement on our MCA tests, and I think there's probably a number of reasons for that. But as we, again, look to narrowing and closing the achievement gap, the MCAs are the one test we have that is a test that tests our state standards, the things that we legislatively determine that students are to be learning. Obviously, we don't mandate curriculum. That is left to the schools to determine and that. But we do have a set of standards that students are to be educated to in our public schools. And the MCA is the test that measures that. And as we look to closing the achievement gap, it is the one test that it spans all of our school districts, all of our schools. And as we have in some areas, some schools in particular, where we've got upwards of 50, 60, 70% of students opting out, it's really making it difficult to know if we're getting a good measurement of student education to our state standards. I do know also there's a level of concern by parents, perhaps by educators and others on, you know, whether these are the right kind of tests. Again, I think all fair points of discussion. I think the MCA tells us certain things that other tests don't tell us, and it is part of our state laws to take them. I know as we will get into the ESSA discussion, I think there is some hope or desire that we could substitute other tests for the MCAs, perhaps specifically at the high school level. But it, again, is my understanding, and I'd be happy to be corrected if that's not the case, but that we still do have to have a test that measures our state standards, and that is the MCAs. We don't have another test that equally measures our state standards. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But, you know, and as we talk about utilizing that test to gauge success, is part of the problem the fact that, quite frankly, the results of those tests really come too late for our schools to address the issues of individual students or to even evaluate the success of their program on an overall basis for that next particular year. It seems to me that if we want to have that test mean something, that we need to have a better turnaround time in terms of usable results for our school districts.
I think that is a very fair point, and I've had some discussions, I would suspect other members have as well, with schools, with the vendor. Pearson is the vendor that administers the test for the state of Minnesota. I've been assured that the results can and probably are turned around to the teachers in within a day or so. I think it's the longer process of calculations, maybe that's done at the department in terms of rolling out statewide data, and that takes a little more time to discern. But with regards to individual students' results, that could be provided. I've long advocated that I think parents need more information to know what it is they're seeing in the results for their students. I think information and advice for if you've got a student showing specific deficiencies in certain areas, ideas of what you could be doing to reinforce learning in those areas over the summer. I certainly wish I had had some of that information when my own children were in school. So I think with regards to the reporting of the test results and that there are improvements we could make that would make it a more useful tools for schools and for teachers and their classroom instruction, without question. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of juggle all these things here with the microphone. I agree with the Chair on the importance of this assessment, and whatever assessment we choose as a state or however we choose it, it's important that we have children taking that test so we know how we're doing and can measure those things. It might be wise to look into why students are opting out. I know there's probably different reasons for different schools. I happen to know a parent in my own school district who is opting out her son because he's on the autism spectrum, and it totally stresses him out. He doesn't do good with these kinds of assessments, and it's just not worthwhile. And I'd hate to see schools penalized for that kind of thing, whereas there may be some schools who potentially are abusing this and opting out students that just maybe wouldn't do well. We don't really know. Might be good to check on that. As for the usability, I know I'm sure Mr. Uni can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking that the results are becoming more and more immediate. As far as I know, they've been working on that, and it's getting more usable in that way. Now, whether it's really usable for classroom instruction is a whole other matter, but it might be worthwhile looking into why students are opting out, especially when they're opting out in large numbers.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. I think that's a really good suggestion or a really good idea. I don't know if we have a study that shows that. Senator Wigan.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bennett. And I would just offer one reason is because the test is meaningless to many high school students, namely one Minnesota college that gives a rip about the outcome on that MCA. They will look at the ACT or the SAT or the Accuplacer, and I had a sponsored a bill that would have had the change for the secondary MCA, and this was supported by the AMSD, Association of Metro School Districts. I had a school board, suburban school board member, a mom, had some of her kids in the audience, so one that said, the test that counts is the one that the college is going to look at. So I agree it's important to get a benchmark on our standards, but you could tweak the ACT or SAT or come up with something else, but it needs to be relevant to students. And that gets out on social media as to, you know, why are we taking this? And I would submit that's a part of it, that students get it, parents get it, and they're saying we want to do what's relevant.
Thank you. I think also that is probably a pretty prevalent point of view for a lot of parents and students. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Wakeman, I've had these discussions before.
as a classroom teacher, I know how important it is, as long as we're standards-based, to teach to the standards. Our whole curriculum supports, we've chosen the curriculum because it supports the standards. And then the MCA is the indicator to us and to the students whether or not they learned the knowledge and skills that are laid out, for example, in the language arts standards or in the math standards or in the science standards. So, you know, to the extent that we can learn what our students know or don't know, the MCA is an important tool. And I don't know if we should have Mr. Uni come forward or not, Madam Chair, to tell us about timelines, but as far as I know, the statement you made is accurate, that we can have immediate turnaround now of scores, which should certainly, even at the 9th, 10th, and 11th grade levels, when those tests are given in the high school, indicate to the student whether they have the basic knowledge and skills, which is what our standards, the benchmarks on which the tests are based, really involve. And that sets a base also for the ACT or the SAT, because it's basic knowledge and skills. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Welcome back, Mr. Uni.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson and members, within taking the test, within a few hours, the school can receive the student's scores. And then it's up to the school of how fast they want to get it to the teacher into the classroom, which is usually pretty quick, but it depends on the school. They get preliminary data for school-wide data pretty soon after that. I think it's around the end of the school year, beginning of the summer. And then there's finalized data that the department works on with the vendors in terms of cleaning it up so that it can be reported out, that comes out later in the summer. The schools do receive, and I can, again, as with other items, I can provide a more formalized timeline to the committee. When I talk with our assessments division, I've actually already got a request in. But later, during the summer, the schools do receive reports that they can send out to parents, but that happens later on in the summer. We have had discussions with members earlier in the session about looking at timelines so that the information is more useful for parents so that they can do summer schooling or any type of programming that's reflective of their scores. So, you know, we are aware of those issues, and I can provide some information about where the opportunities may or may not lie right there. But then a lot of the timeline is spread out in terms of public release of data, because we want to make sure that there's no individual data attached to any of the scores and that all of the data is clean and absolutely correct, because we know that parents look at scores and that has an impact on schools in terms of how parents choose those schools. I would be remiss if I didn't reiterate what the commissioner had said about attaching the MCA scores to compensatory revenue. We do know that the correlations, and again, I'm asking the team if we have information on this in terms of where the concentration of opt-outs are, but we do know, at least from anecdotal evidence, that a lot of the opt-outs are occurring amongst our middle class and higher income students. And if we're attaching that to revenue streams that benefit lower income students, we find the lack of equity there, that we're putting the actions of our middle class and higher income students on the backs of our lower income students.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. And one question I had, do you know if the schools send out anything to parents at the beginning of the year or in advance of MCA testing, kind of emphasizing the importance of taking the test or encouraging students and parents to take the test, or that parents allow their students to take the test? Well, I know there's an opt-out form and a procedure, but I'm wondering if there's also, coupled with that, information on why it can be valuable to a student to take the test.
Madam Chair, members, Madam Chair, you are correct that I believe it was last year that the legislature required the department to create an opt-out form for districts to provide their students. I believe the Senate bill is carrying some language that would require schools to communicate with their students about the values of the MCAs. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly what that requires of the districts, but I believe that was at least in the Senate bill at one time or another. I'm not sure if Senator Pratt can speak to that. But as of now, the responsibility lies just with the local decision and then the opt-out form.
Thank you, Mr. Uni. Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I wanted to touch on a different question. Mr. Uni, you said that we get back the results and we have to make sure they're clean and correct. That, to me, sounds like an aggregation issue, not an individual student issue.
are we finding errors in the individual student records?
Mr. Rooney.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I can't speak to that specifically in terms of actual incidents. Again, I'm asking our division to come back kind of with the timeline, and I can speak a little bit more to the details there. I don't believe that we're finding what we would characterize as errors. I think it's probably more of an issue of just verifying accuracy of the information, and that's just making sure that errors don't arise.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the things we see continually through both the House and the Senate proposal is really making sure that the data from those MCAs is available and useful for making decisions for the student, whether it's compensatory, whether it's third grade reading, whether it's, you know, go through the list. I think there are several instances where we've referenced the MCAs, and so it does become a valuable tool for us. Maybe not so much at the high school level as it has been in the lower grades, but my fear is that we're starting to see in some areas where the MCAs, the disaggregation is becoming statistically insignificant.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. And I'm trying to remember, and I know staff was looking at this, but Senator Wigger, you may recall, I know we had some discussion about whether or not the MCA scores could be utilized by, I think, our state colleges here, the Minn State or formerly Minsky system, and there was some discussion about having a having those scores be substituted for ACTs. Am I remembering that correctly, that we did have that provision in the bill, or was it just a discussion point?
Madam Chair, it was a discussion point, and I believe that if you receive a certain level, you can waive having to take remediation courses. So it, you know, it does have some bearing, but it's nothing like the ACT or SAT or ACCUPLACER, which has a more of an overall impact, especially on scholarships and other considerations.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rooney, do you have any data on the opt-out grades, the percentage, or what grade has the greatest percentage of opt-out, for example, in 3 through 8 and then at the high school level? Do you have any of that data?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I have actually put in a request to Assistant Commissioner McHenry for that information. I'll provide that to committee immediately when I get it.
Thank you, Mr. Rooney. So following up on that question with Senator Wigger to jog my own memory, so NDE has been involved with discussions with higher ed about that, and could you tell us how those discussions have gone?
Madam Chair, members, as you remember last session, there was a proposal to have the MCA scores be part of the consideration for Minsky Institution. This was a proposal. Be part of the considerations in the acceptance into the institution. The remediation portion did pass. The final legislation did have the Minsky Chancellor reviewing the MCA scores, and then if for the usage of in the higher education context, and if they were issues found with the scores in terms of methodology to point out the issues and provide recommendations for an acceptable matter. It's been a while since I've taken a look at the report. Again, another thing that I can provide to the committee in terms of what was found and what actions have been taken forward. But I do know that Minsky did come back to the department with recommendations for remediating that score system.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. I do know, I believe there is some research that shows a correlation between scoring proficient and your probability of success in an institution of higher learning.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, we found MDA did do some alignment studies in terms of what a proficiency score on our 8th grade MCAs would be in terms of how it would correlate with an ACT score, but that was an MDE study that we did. The outside sources and the Minsky took a look at that.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? All right. Seeing none, I think we'll go ahead and turn then to a next topic. ESSA language and performance plans. And I think, is that just a House provision? I believe so. So, Representative Erickson, if you want to go ahead and that was something that you were very integral in, want to lead us in a discussion about the House provisions on that and rationale and discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is R-71, and there's a same a provision, or if similar, I think the language is exactly the same, on R-71, Senate side section 42, and House side section 35. Excuse me, Article 2. Article 2. So what we were asking for was probably premature because we thought perhaps the department would have the plan ready during this legislative session. So we were asking that the commissioners submit the state plan to the legislative bodies, the committees, finance, and policy, before submitting it to the Department of Education. And then further, the House added something. So I think I need Mr. Ooney to come back to the table because the commissioner and I have discussed this. And Mr. Ooney can correct me if I'm not accurate. But in regard to the same language in Article 2, R-71, Section 42 of the Senate and Section 35 of the House, the commissioner and I did discuss, because the plan will not be submitted during this legislative session. She is still refining it, but that we could hold joint hearings, probably in policy, Senator Pratt, to receive a draft, maybe the middle of May. Mm-hmm. I know that's going to be a very busy time, but the commissioner was certainly amenable to our hearing the draft, and then perhaps in mid-July, the final draft. But at that time, there would be no opportunity for us to probably amend it because it's due August 1 or thereabouts. So I think, Mr. Ooney, I have been accurate in stating that, but let me hear what the committee heard from you.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, again, I would just like to thank Representative Erickson for having a conversation with the commissioner and the department around the ESSA work. As is required and as we really want to do is consultation with the legislature. I think it's really important for the people's representatives around the state to be able to engage with it. Do want to remind, we've engaged with over 150 stakeholders over the course of the last year, so we've really tried very, very hard, but we're more than open to continue that. I believe our submission deadline is September 18th, but we do want to get a plan out for public comment in the midsummer, and so we'll have an opportunity to, I believe, in mid-May to discuss a lot of the work that we've done and plans that we're going to go put into the plan and to look at a more fully formed plan later on in the summer that we can share with you all. But the concerns that, and I'll reiterate what the commissioner said, the concerns that we had about the approval process, should the legislature want to make any changes, would delay the implementation that we would have to put in. So the U.S. DOE has, I believe, 120 days to accept our plan, do any comments, and then approve or deny. And if we were to do any revisions to it, another 90 days. But their full expectation is that we implement immediately upon getting it. As the commissioner has said, you know, about $238 million is dependent on our federal plans or agreements with the federal government based on the federal law that they have. And they expect that when we submit the plan that it's representative of all the consultation that we've done with stakeholders, including the legislature. And so we would hope that the legislature would carry on with these planned hearings to fully engage on that. We will fully intend and welcome that conversation, and then have us submit to the department, and we'll go from their approved plan.
Madam Chair, I told the commissioner we would take under consultation whether or not we would want to see the plan again before it's implemented. But that will be a continuing conversation. Then to the house language on R71, starting with paragraph B, the commissioner and I have discussed with Mr. Uni present some of the concerns and some of the interests that she has as well in the rest of this proposal. And this is language that we're going to refine because it is a little confusing, maybe more than a little confusing, because one phrase that was, I think, missed by the commissioner was the phrase "to the extent practicable." So she and I had lengthy discussions about what is practicable and what's available in data, and to separate probably elementary and secondary. But in paragraph I, on the reading and math growth, using growth to proficiency standards, I think the stakeholders, and Mr. Uni will comment on this, have been amenable to that and have, in fact, liked that provision. We do have data available on third grade reading proficiency. We do have data available on eighth grade mathematics proficiency. Now, whether or not these would be included in the final draft, I'm not sure, but they are certainly important to us, and I would hope important to stakeholders and to parents and students and teachers as well. Science proficiency, we do not have a data that would be, I think, used in the state plan, but it is something that we probably should keep our eye on so that we are tracking that. Career and college readiness of high school students, you know, right now we have career and college readiness beginning at third grade. So the commissioner and I did discuss whether or not that should continue. We would say that it is more likely that by eighth grade we could determine the career and college readiness of a student. So that's still under discussion. The high school accountability assessments, that will be in ESSA. Then when we move on to the other paragraphs on R72, or the other items, I should say, student success or attainment on advanced placement or international baccalaureate is information that we could have on the website of the school districts because they would know which students, or how many students, I should say, not which students, how many students scored threes or fours. So that data could be available if we chose to have school districts report that out. But it is not something that the commissioner and I thought would be contained in the ESSA plan. The college level examination program examinations, those are required by the world's best workforce, but they are, again, local level reporting in that we could know how many have taken a college level examination. This is concurrent enrollment. Under the next paragraph, the credits, that would be PSEO. Again, we have data on the number of credits that are earned, you know, that report that we receive, committee. So we would know that data, and that could be reported out locally. The industry-recognized certifications, that could be reported locally, too. That information is available, but probably would not be used in an ESSA plan, but as I said earlier, all of this is still under discussion because I am rewriting this for an amendment to the omnibus bill, and we'll keep in mind the phrase, the infinitive phrase, "to the extent practicable," because we are not going to be unreasonable. I would say that the commissioner has had a lot of stakeholder meetings, and there's been a lot of good input, and so I think we'll be able to look forward to a quite a I think a very good draft when we first review it in mid-May, if we're able to arrange such a meeting. But maybe Mr. Ooney would like to comment further on some of my statements. Mr. Ooney.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, members, thank you for the overview of the discussion, and again for listening to the explanation from the Commissioner and being willing to reformat the language. I will say just on one point on I think as I remember the conversation correctly, and again we can maybe smooth this out in conversations offline, is a concern about the focusing on the bottom quartile for reading and math performance. I need to delve in a little bit more with the team to see if that needs to be reformatted a little bit. I will note that on some of the areas like the AP and IB exams, the college level, or the concurrent enrollment, PSEO, the discussion was around having districts more in the world's best workforce model of reporting it out at their sites. I think a lot of the stakeholders did want to see this information. The issue about the usability was equal access to these programs, and we wouldn't have an apples-to-apples comparison across the different schools across the state. There is interest about getting that information into an accountability system in the future when we reach a little bit more of an equity in use of these programs, but we really want to be using data points that really have a meaningful comparative value. And then on the science proficiency, that was simply the stakeholders didn't, the expert stakeholders didn't see the utility of the science in this accountability, the science exams and the accountability framework as much as they did for reading and math, and wanted to hold off on those, using those scores as well. And again, just to reiterate that a lot of these items are very useful information for communities and parents, but at this time, best placed, again, through the World's Best Workforce model of presenting that information on the school's websites or disseminating to parents in some form or manner.
And Madam Chair, I would still argue that in paragraph I, that reading and math growth for students performing in the bottom quartile is still an important bit of data, or important data for us to know. And then, of course, using growth through proficiency, I think that's very amenable to most everyone. But I think we can continue to have discussions about that. Thank you, Mr. Ooney.
Thank you, Representative Richardson, and thank you, Mr. Ooney. And just a question on this, as we are moving through, obviously you're having discussions with conference committee members and that on this. I'm assuming you and the commissioner are empowered to, give authority or offer sort of the administration's opinion, so as we work through these issues, we can settle some of them and then move forward to adopt language?
Madam Chair, members, I believe we've obviously gone down the path of we're doing a full omnibus bill, but I would have to repeat that the governor would like to see clean finance bills. But as the situation we find ourselves in, I think there are provisions such as this where we can offer the advice to make these provisions workable for the commissioner and the committee going forward.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ooney. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I've listened to this discussion, I guess the one point I'm still somewhat unclear on, does the development of the ESSA plan, does that trigger any additional effort and work on the part of our local school districts to be reporting additional information in addition to the world's best workforce at this point in time?
I'll actually have Representative Erickson respond to that.
Madam Chair and Senator Weber, to the extent that they've not been reporting out that information that I was referring to, that would be part of the world's best workforce, yes and no, because they have the data, they just haven't been reporting it out. But it really does align with the world's best workforce goals as laid out in our legislation that we enacted several years ago. So they have the data. So it wouldn't be that they have to find new data. They have the data. It would be a matter of putting it on their website so parents, teachers, and students know, and other stakeholders.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then would we be at that point amending our reporting format for the World's Best Workforce to include all that data in at one time rather than part of the workforce and then something extra? I mean, is that the desired goal here when we're done?
Representative Erickson? Madam Chair, well, I'm not exactly sure, Senator Weber, but I do think the expectation is already there under the world's best workforce. When we consider high school accountability assessments, you know, the assessments that we use are advanced placement, international baccalaureate, of course, the MCAs, that's first. We have a lot of concurrent enrollment. We have many students enrolled in PSEO, and we have students earning industry-recognized certifications. All of this information does support the world's best workforce under career and college readiness of high school students, as measured by what I've just listed. So I think it's all there, and it does support the world's best workforce. It's a matter of putting the data on the website. Okay. And I suppose that'll take more work, yes. Probably hear about it.
Senator Weger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, is there an expectation, I believe, in world's best workforce that students are ready for K, and especially given the growing investment by the legislature in achieving that goal?
Representative Erickson, Madam Chair, and Senator Weger, the world's best workforce, you know, is designed so that there is an expectation that they'll be working toward achieving those goals. So it isn't that they have to, it's always working toward achieving them. But yes, that is one of them, that they're ready for kindergarten. That's in the world's best workforce.
Right. Thank you. And Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, thank you. You stated a number of the benchmarks in the House language that world's best workforce is based on, but I didn't see anything on ready for K, and that was more of my point.
And Madam Chair, Representative Leader, I think that's because there's no assessment in pre-K or K through 2. The assessments begin in grade 3. So.
Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps this will be a discussion on early education later, but if we say students should be ready for K, and how do we know if they're ready for K if it's not measured?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Weaver, we're hoping that that legislative audit reveals that, or Representative Bloom's provision in the bill to take a look at all the early education programs to find out, you know, what screening is done and what assessments might occur. We don't want to, I don't think, require assessments that early in a child's education because our children are at 4 years of age, variable in their maturation. And the same is true in kindergarten and actually in first and second grades, too. But we do have to pay attention to what is happening to them in all of those levels once they start in kindergarten.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Ehrman, did you want to add something? You look like you're poised to say something.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to this last point, Madam Chair, members, yes, while school readiness is, or ready for K is an indicator, unfortunately we haven't been able to provide a statewide indicator or even regional indicator because we don't have in law a consistent requirement for schools to use the same assessment to measure kindergarten readiness. We do have a pilot that measures 10% as a voluntary opt-in by 10% of students, representing 10% of students. Obviously, that's not the 100% that we want to get to. We offer a suite of four assessments for districts to use, and they're not comparable. We don't have the funding to provide it statewide of one test. We have come in the past for what we call the KEP, kindergarten entry profile, and that I believe, and I would have to go back and check, is about a cost of about $1.5 million a year to get a statewide information on kindergarten readiness.
Thank you, Mr. Ernie. Other questions or comments on the ESSA topic?
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Just one more question of Mr. Ernie. The Commissioner and I discussed the lack of understanding of the language arts standards in the field. We had an extensive discussion about, you know, when they change, their difficulty, the difficulty of the test. So what does the department plan to do in regard to fulfilling this grave need that I think we have that our teachers, and as far as language arts, that's across the board. You know, we read at all levels and in all courses or subject areas. But what does the commissioner plan to do as far as helping those school districts who may indicate that those teachers still do not have a clear understanding of the standards in special ed language arts?
Mr. Ernie?
Madam Chair, Representative Eric, and members, as both bodies saw, we did do presentations on ELA implementation, and we were just as disappointed in the uptake of ELA implementation around the state. It has been difficult for districts, and we haven't stood flat-footed. Right now, we are in the final stages of constructing a ELA implementation toolkit based out of our standards division, but it is really cross-divisional. So while the standards division has led the charge, they have worked with each and every other division that touches upon ELA implementation. It will be an on-site online website portal that teachers and school leadership teams can use to effectively and better implement their ELA standards. We also hope, should the legislature continue to fund the regional centers of excellence, to have our expert teams that are out in the ground, mostly in greater Minnesota, working with school leadership teams around the state and making sure that these ELA standards are more implemented and we ramp up and have a more purposeful effort. So using the tool that we have centralized at the department and using the, you know, somewhat times limited capacity we have to work with districts statewide, and then hopefully through our expert teams on the ground in our regional centers.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other comments or questions?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. One more thing that I wanted to mention, just to Senator Weber's questions around anything above and beyond World's Best Workforce. I just want to let the committee know that the department has and the stakeholders have been very intentional in trying to align what our federal plan is around what we have as a World's Best Workforce Accountability Plan. We do believe that this is a very good model that's had a lot of input, and we know the districts and charters have worked very hard to get on board with this, and so we're really trying to model the federal accountability plan in the idea of World's Best Workforce so that we're trying as much to limit duplication of effort and really trying to make our work with the federal government really aligned with our work at the local level in our communities.
And Madam Chair, that would be one accountability system, so that's very good. One accountability system.
Thank you. Yes, I think that's important. I think our schools would appreciate that too. If there's no other comments on this particular topic, we'll turn to the next. Thank you, Mr. Ooney, but you may not want to go far. let's see. Third grade reading, and I think that was primarily Senate, mm-hmm. Senate provisions. Mm-hmm. So reading by third grade, and Senator Pratt, I think that was something maybe that you spearheaded as part of your policy bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the section that we're talking about, section 4, starts on page R4, at section 4 in the Senate file, line 22-5, and it goes on for a number of pages. I'd like to really talk about the changes that we make.
And do you know which article it's in?
That's Article 2.
Article 4,
okay.
Page R4. Okay. Page R4, Article 2. All right, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we did a number of changes, and they really fall into two categories. The first set of changes I'll talk about really came from the department. Currently, we have three areas of statute that describe interventions for students not reading at grade level. Each area of law is governed by a different program, receives funding from different sources, and has separate reporting requirements. So the goal of this multi-tiered system of support described in the Senate bill
is supposed to help connect and identify programs and resources available to local schools and teachers and help them connect and help connect them in a way that best serves each student. So specifically from the department, we are tying reading intervention laws and other areas of statute into the third grade proficiency statute. We're creating detailed definitions to clearly describe reading intervention methods and related terminology, requiring schools to use intensive intervention for struggling students before referring them to special education, ensuring parent notification of students' progress, and setting minimum standards for innovation methods that ensure reading interventions used in schools are evidence-based and complete. The second piece of the language was inspired by a visit the commissioner and I had to a celebration school. In talking with the principal, I asked her why she was so successful. And her answer to me was, well, we're very intentional. We focus on each student as an individual. And so, Madam Chair, what you find on page R8 of that article, and Senate lines 25 through 6 through 25-16, is really trying to codify that expectation that we do, in fact, be intentional for students. What we do is we develop the concept of a personalized learning plan for students not reading at grade level, understanding if they're already on an IEP that they're covered. And the goal of this is really to understand the root cause of why a student's not reading at grade level by the end of third grade. It could be for a number of reasons. They move from another state with different standards or expectations. They have some personal issues that they're dealing with. Maybe English isn't their primary language. We could come up with a lot of different options, but the idea is to make sure that the plan that we put into place addresses the specific needs of the students. The other issue, and what that allows us to do in cooperation with the department's language, is to really tie those interventions together so that a school may use one or many of the interventions that are currently available to them. We're not defining any new interventions. We're not defining any new strategies. The learning plan is supposed to be in consultation with the parents. One of the issues that Senator Rieger and I worked out last year on this language was to make sure that we weren't putting together a program that was labor-intensive as the IEP. And so we leave the format of the personalized learning plan in the hands of the local districts. They should be working with their teachers to figure out how to best put together this plan, be able to communicate it to parents, and then assess the results and make any changes to the plans. But I do want to reiterate, this is not intended to be as in-depth as the IEP. We know that third grade reading is one of the most important metrics that we have in looking at student success and whether or not a student drops out or not. And my hope is that we're not waiting until third grade to identify these students and start some of these remediation plans, that they're being identified earlier as we, just had the conversation, but rather to make sure that we're not losing focus on these students and to make sure that, as the principal at the celebration school said, we are in fact being intentional and utilizing that best practice across the state.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. That was a good explanation. Just a quick question from your experience at that celebration school. Did they develop sort of the kind of plan that you have outlined in the Senate bill with regards to, I assume, with any proposal, you bring in the parents, you sit down. I'm envisioning a school conference where concerns are raised about progress in reading and a plan is developed. Is that something the school is using? And that's kind of, am I in the right mindset here when I think about how this would operate?
Madam Chair, sure, you're always in the right mindset. yes, you are. In fact, that's part of their intentional is that they have a plan and an assessment of every student already in process. And when I've talked to my local superintendents, they've looked at this and they've said, we already do this. And so for a lot of schools, this is not going to be an issue. They already do it. The concern is going to be in those schools where we see a third of our third graders not reading at grade level. And that goes up to almost half when you include the special ed students. But take them out, take those out because they have IEPs. Just those students without IEPs, nearly a third of them aren't reading at grade level. And that's why this is so important.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pratt, do you have an example of an individual personal learning plan or a sample?
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. No, I don't. And it's very personal to that child. I never asked for one. What I do know is that the principal and the school district have said that the principal has said that they do develop these plans for each student. I couldn't tell you how formal or informal it is. The idea is that they're being intentional and they're focusing on the needs of that specific student. I don't want us to dictate a format. I think each individual school district, working with their local teachers, should develop a program that works for them.
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, if we do that, then how do we know that they're doing that?
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Murphy. I think we don't know. There's no reporting back. The idea of the reading well by third grade was not to put in a number of mandates. Representative Erickson and I talked about this last year, that we don't necessarily want to put a number of mandates in schools. What we're doing here is setting an expectation that these students should be evaluated and strategies developed for their specific needs. So I don't view this as a mandate. I view it as an expectation.
I'm sorry. I can't see around. Mr. Hessick, did you have more comments, Representative Murphy?
No.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very important discussion for us to have, and I would like to just I'd like to have us focus on a couple real, I would say, in a sense, a very important statistics regarding the importance of third grade reading. 87% of students who do not graduate on time are struggling in third grade. Think about that. And then compare that with 89% of our at-risk kids, the kids that we focus so much on to make sure we target our resources so they get equal opportunities, because we know education is the great equalizer, and we're very cognizant of that. 88% of students at risk who did graduate on time were proficient readers in third grade. So clearly, if we're talking about closing achievement gaps, certainly third grade literacy is absolutely key. I believe making sure kids are ready for kindergarten when they get there is our first step. And then the second step, if we really want to change the trajectory of our students and their opportunities going forward, the second step for that is third grade literacy. And I would also recall, I had to ask Mr. Marcus about this because I couldn't recall where we were now with this. But when I was a Title I teacher, there was actually a requirement that students who were not reading proficiently in grade 3 were given options that the school district paid for them to get the necessary tutoring that they needed. I believe that's not in existence anymore, if I understood correctly. Is that correct, Mr. Marcus?
I'm sorry, Senator Nelson, as I understood the question, I wasn't going quite that far back in Title I history. I thought we were referring to what was formerly under No Child Left Behind called supplemental education services.
Yes, it was that far behind in Title I when I was teaching. I did get that. But, no, so the point is we in the past have realized how important this early literacy is, that we have actually directed funds to tutorial options for students who are not succeeding. So I think this is a very cognizant, a very focused step to closing the achievement gap. And I particularly appreciate Senator Pratt's focus on making sure that it's not it does not become an overly burdensome mandate and the bureaucracy and paperwork. So I think if we are truly serious about closing the achievement gap, this is a very small and significant step that we can take.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Other comments? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know I have the expert sitting next to me, the most recently retired teacher in of kindergarten, first grade. But I've been tracking my kindergarten grandson and, you know, just observing his teacher, who, by the way, knows the kindergarten reading, the ELA standards very, very well. I tracked around those because I've observed a number of times. But at the cognitive level now, as we push our four-year-olds into the classroom, I think it's going to get wider and wider because their maturation levels at 4 years and even 5 years, which is the point I was going to make in observing my grandson's kindergarten class. You know, Senator Pratt, this is going to be almost overwhelming for those teachers. I know that this is a really, really good idea, but, you know, they do informal assessments all the time, but as we begin the earlier education, we're going to have many more children, I think, who aren't going to be at the cognitive level of what is expected now, probably at kindergarten. That'll now revert to pre-K, because I would say that what is being taught in kindergarten now used to be taught in first grade, and I bet Representative Bennett would attest to that as a teacher. So, you know, we have to be careful in how we proceed in our demands on teachers you know, requiring a personalized learning plan. I think that's a great idea. I think they probably already do it. But, you know, I hope that this doesn't turn out to be a mandate on their having to do this in addition to perhaps what later might be an IEP, which I hope is avoided, because we are doing this early intervention. But, you know, let's keep in mind that our children are going to be at a wide variety of cognitive levels and maturation levels, social levels. The earlier we start them in school in this organized way of educating, and we have to be ready for that. And I have great sympathy for teachers as I watch my grandson's kindergarten teacher and how hard she has to work with those. She has 24 little ones, and boy, I tell you, they're all over the place in their cognitive ability. So if that's true at kindergarten, I know it's going to be worse at the pre-K level, and it's going to continue. So, you know, let's be sure that we go forth with a great understanding of the challenge that we're presenting. We want the children to be ready for fourth grade, to be reading at that grade three level. But, you know, let's make sure that our teachers are well equipped to do that as well, and that parents understand their responsibility, and, of course, the children, too. But, you know, they're just children.
Senator
Pratt? Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erickson, and I can't disagree with anything you've said. This is not meant to be, you know, any sort of cast aspersion on any teachers. And, in fact, I know the assessments are happening at early grades. I'm glad they're happening at early grades. This is not meant to affect every student in every grade. But even with the strategies and the assessments and even the extra work that these kids are getting in first and second grade, we still have a third of them that are passing through third grade and not meeting the standards. This is not meant to replace any of that. It's simply meant to be a safety net to catch these kids before they fail and before they fall two grade levels behind and qualify for special ed.
We need to sing more, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. We haven't talked about Rock and Read, but we will.
I'm waiting.
Me too. That's a good idea. So, Senator Pratt, but I, you know, that little discussion was helpful. I think it answered my question. I'll just clarify for you. So these personalized plans would not kick in until after the third grade. I think it's a statewide assessment. So after the third grade MCAs.
Which is why it's so important, Madam Chair, that we get the data in a meeting in a time that can be used by teachers
in a very quick manner. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Senator Weaker.
Yes, Madam Chair, I want to disclose I was a chief author of this earlier, and I know it's going to be additional work, but this is tragic, what's happening with these students. And you heard the statistics about the probability of not graduating, of diminished earnings, etc. I'm not sure if the high probability that you're going to end up in prison, the 85% probability you're going to be a juvenile delinquent, it's very sad, and you acknowledge it, and we need to do everything we can. And yes, we'll talk more about early education and the kindergarten, all the efforts and all that, so that you are ready. But we have a local way for the districts, the school boards, to come up with a way to better inform the parents to get a plan for those students. And we have to do that. Less than 60% of Minnesota students are reading proficiently. And we have to do whatever we can to address that. If we need to put some additional funds in the training that's necessary, so be it. But I speak strongly for that.
Oh, thank you, Senator Weaker. And it just struck, because obviously all of the things we do are connected in some manner. I didn't know if our staff had any information. I'm hearkening back to my extended parent discussion in compensatory. If we know how much extended time that our schools are doing is devoted to maybe elementary school or in that sort of third to fifth grade range, is that anything we'd be able to get? Or maybe that would be a department question? Mr. Uni? Thank you. Just if you heard the question, I'm just curious. Again, this is more just me wondering if we have any information on, you know, obviously most schools get extended time revenue for students and that. If we have any idea of the breakdown of how schools utilize that, and if we would know what percentage is utilized for maybe the category of students we're talking about, maybe third to fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Is that any information the department might have?
Madam Chair, members, I will put that on the list of things to send to staff. I am sending stuff out and I am receiving things, so I imagine I can get that in short order if we do have it.
If you have it. Thank you very much. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one thing to add to that wish list, Mr. Uni, I also think it would be important to know of our extended time endeavors, what are they dedicated to? Are they dedicated to literacy? Some are. They're dedicated to math, or is it a rounded approach? But as we're talking about the importance of early literacy here and the third grade being a watershed year for being proficient readers, if we have extended programs for those younger years, those younger grades, it would be helpful to know how many of them are focused on that early literacy piece.
Chair, Senator Nelson, I do believe that we have a report on our strategies for students who are in alternative settings, which heavily rely on extended time revenue, and we have a compilation of strategies. I don't know if we've quantified that in terms of percentages, so I don't want to raise expectations, but I know we do have information around the different strategies that districts and charters are using.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. Appreciate it. All right. I'm sorry, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rooney, when you're looking at Senator Pratt's proposal, for the reading proficiency no later than the end of grade 3. As you look at the definitions, do you know through your reading specialists at the department whether or not these definitions are already in place in their reading programs, or are these going to be new to what it is that the department is helping instructors with? Mr. Ernie.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, these definitions come directly from the working group that convened, I believe, in 2014, I believe. There was legislation passed in 2013 around multi-tiered systems of supports. These are definitions in the report, definitions that came from all the stakeholders' meetings. So I do believe that these definitions represent best practices definitions that a lot of programs operate under. So this will just be providing commonly held understanding definitions as we channel these funding streams and strategies through into the classroom.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Thank you, Mr. Ooney. All right. Thank you. Any other comments on the reading by third grade provisions of the Senate bill? All right. Thank you. Thank you, especially Senator Pratt. Good discussion. All right. So the last item I thought we would try to go through today is on education partnerships. Both House and Senate bills have provisions in, but they're a little bit different in their approach. So Article 9, R1 is the pertinent area in their books for those. And let's see, Senator Nelson, did you want to start or one of your other conference members just to discuss the Senate take on this, and then I'd be happy to show in the House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the first thing I would just to set the stage a little bit is that, as I think we all have found, that these partnerships have, in the short amount of time that they've been in existence, they have shown dramatic results. They have shown good results in particularly those areas that we would look at as closing the achievement gap, and also I look at them as two-generation models, actually. But the dilemma that we were left with in the Senate was that, first I should tell you, our Senate mission was to focus on students and fund what works. And what we found is these are working, and we would like to actually fund more of them. But the challenge is these are not your K-12 schools. And to continue to take $2 million of highly competitive education funding for the community education or the community partnership programs, we thought that maybe there's a better way to do that. And so the Senate bill actually looks at continuing funding for the existing NAS and St. Paul Promise neighborhood at half of their current funding. They're already up and running. They're doing a great job. We want to encourage more community partnership, more of our private entrepreneur or our private philanthropers to also help with this. Our businesses have been very involved because this is certainly an issue to them to make sure that they have a high-quality workforce that they need, and, of course, this starts with making sure we have well-educated kids. So our position in the Senate is to take what's working and look at how can we expand it on a more broader statewide scale. And so the idea is to continue funding those that have started, that are successful, but at a lower rate, and repurpose those funds then for grants that could be used for funding other such sites across the state. It is important to note that the ones that are just getting started to Greater Minnesota would receive that full funding that they were anticipating, because they're not as far off the ground yet. So you do need to fund to get started. And once those results start coming in, we would like to be the seed money that allows for this type of expansion of highly effective programs, two-generation models in other parts throughout the state, without putting additional undue competitive pressure upon the K-12 funds.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. And so I'll just talk a little bit about the House approach, which is a little bit different, and then we can have discussion over these two different ideas. I think we both recognize the importance and the success of these organizations, and really growing up out of a community deciding that they need to marshal various partners, the school districts, community volunteers, business community, philanthropic organizations, and bring everyone together to engender a change that provides for greater success for their students. And I think it's an exciting concept. It's something that we are seeing work very well in some neighborhoods and communities across our state. I think growing that is important. We've got a model now that it works, and these organizations can be great examples to other communities of how you can make this work and how you can get results by bringing everyone together. I guess one of the things that I've like to see in looking at this, and there's obviously two different approaches here. I don't think there's a right or a wrong way, but is looking to make sure that there is sort of support outside of state funds that is strong and consistent and will be there as a strong presence within the community organizations. Because, as you know, state funding could ebb and flow. Sometimes we put a little money out there as seed to see if something happens or fill in some gaps. But I think it's important that these organizations are really driven primarily by their local partners and communities to make sure that they stay strong. And so that's the one thing that I worry about a little bit. If the funding comes in from the state perhaps too early or in a disproportional way, that the other support from other partners may be lessened, and that is of concern, because we want these to be vibrant organizations that are there for the long term, because that's how we really get excellent results. So just a slightly different approach again, but we've got two good ideas here and some great community education partnerships. So, but we will have to grapple with coming up with one bill and one concept. So, with that, I would welcome comments from other committee members about their ideas or thoughts they'd like to share. Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of thoughts along what you said. I had a chance to meet with a couple of these organizations, and I think the aha moment for me was when I recognized that this wasn't necessarily focusing on the student in the classroom. This was really helping to build stronger families and helping the student by making sure that their life was stable and secure. By helping the parents through parenting classes, by helping them get jobs that would able to help them provide better for their family, and that's where the aha moment for community partnerships had. One concept we had in an early version of the Senate bill was that the Senate funds would be capped at a 50% rate, so we would match them dollar for dollar on what they raised. I also want to speak in favor of Senator Nelson's proposal that would allow some local funding to be utilized through community education at the local district's discretion. I think that's a good way to bring. The school districts are probably the key partner in many of these initiatives, and I think they need the opportunity to be able to help support them financially as well.
Thank you, Senator Pratt. And Senator Nelson.
Yeah, and I think I just wanted to add on to that, and thank you for bringing that up, Senator Pratt. I think I neglected to mention the community education opportunities there. But it is, as we were discussing this and looking at the success and what all it does, which is much outside the classroom but provides great
supportive measures for success in the classroom, that's where community education came to mind. That is what they do. They do a tremendous job with many aspects of education with adults and kids and those. Parents are important in Rochester, which has been helping parents be successful for decades. And there's things like this all across the state. And so the idea was to look at that partnership with community ed as well. And I would also speak to, I do think there is that importance of a local participation and local buy-in and local skin in the game. And so I'm hopeful that I think we can meld these two good ideas into something that will be really helpful for expanding these type of programs statewide.
Thank you. And just so I'm clear on this, would your concept in the Senate bill embody then sort of community ed, or maybe the community ed director being kind of the driver of getting this started within the community, or it could be a variety of different ways it would start up?
First, I'll turn to my fiscal staff, to my staff, to speak about that. I don't think we fleshed out the exact mechanism for that yet. It was the new idea of thinking, you know, we should look at community ed. We've got strong community eds. They're doing these type of things, and how can we maximize that? So I think there's plenty of room here to improve this and make it better. But is there anything else that we want to add on the community ed side, any of my staff? Do you want to add anything else about our community ed discussions in here?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I think you're right in that the Senate language implies that as others have described, the key partner in these coalitions might be the school district. And through the community ed program or director, the district would be primarily responsible for applying for the grant, administering the funds. But as the language implies, that other community programs, other school programs in and outside of community ed, mm-hmm. would be engaged and in the competitive grant process, a district that perhaps demonstrated in their application a particularly strong idea or a particularly powerful local match, in either in terms of in-kind or monetary resources, would have an advantage in the competitive application.
And then, Madam Chair, just to add some further detail to that, and the operative word there is may. So the new piece of this is that community education may, whereas up until this point, they would not be allowed to participate. So it would not preclude what's working anywhere else or where how things may work going forward. It just adds one more partner possibility to the mix by the permissive word of may.
Thank you. That's helpful in fully understanding your proposal. I appreciate that. Other comments? Senator Weaker.
Yes. Madam Chair, I just wanted to add my enthusiastic support for integrative services. And this is the best way to close the achievement gap, and starting early and with the family involvement in the community. And we're not discussing now the full-service community school, where you know the governor had some money as well, but there's a number of programs that we funded as well that potentially might be discussed later as the governor weighs in more on this subject. And I know we have a great program in Rochester for full-service schools, different parts of the state, but it uses the same concepts in community education and with the school as the key part of that process.
Yes, and it did sound very much like the full-service community school concept. Other comments, questions? All right. Either everyone's getting tired, or we've run through all of the new ideas, the new things to talk about. Now, obviously, these programs have been around for a few years, so people are familiar with them, and I'm sure you had great hearings on them, as I know we did in the House as well, too. So, all right. With that, those were just sort of the topics I had hoped that we could kind of talk through today, and I think this has been very helpful as we move forward in our conference process to have these discussions and kind of hear what people are thinking. So thank you, and thank you especially, Mr. Uni. I know we had you back and forth a number of times, and you came away with a pretty lengthy to-do list on information requests. We appreciate it very much, so thank you for that. Let's see. I guess future meetings would be up to Senator Nelson. She would have the gavel next, and I didn't know if you had any plans yet or to be announced, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In a sense, it's to be announced. We do have a lot of preliminary work to do. I want to make sure that our conference committee times are well spent, and I know that everyone is busy, so we want to make sure we have things that will be essential for us to go through. And whether or not, at this point, I'm looking at Thursday. If we can make significant progress, maybe it would be Wednesday, but I would say if you're looking, you know, maybe 60% chance that it would be on Thursday, maybe 40% that we'd be meeting on Wednesday. So nothing affirmative yet, but we will be sure and get that posted as soon as possible.
All right. Thank you, Senator Nelson. And so I know that you and your staff will be letting us know as soon as those decisions are made. And with that, if there's no other questions or anything else to come before the committee, we are adjourned for today. Thank you.